Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of the Two Sporting Muppets, where we take a very lighthearted look at the week, or this time, fortnight in sport. Welcome to the microphone, Gray.
Hi Greg, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I've had a good week. Apologies for missing the pod last week. I have to take responsibility for that, but we're back at it this week.
Our truckloads of listeners, mate, were disappointed, I'm sure, but we're back fortnight later. Look, Greg, what do you have to chat about? World Cups galore. It has been the last month. We'll have a chat about the T20 and the Rugby League World Cup. We'll also look a little bit at the NRL, Wallabies, a few woes there at the moment, some AFL, Soccer World Cup, and NBL, and as usual, our US, a little bit of a US look. And our deep dive, look, we were chatting before about one day cricket, and we have sort of spoken in short about it over a few episodes. So today's the day where we actually have a half-decent chat about what we think the future of it is.
Yeah, where's the 50-over game stand, and more importantly, where's it going? And we record this on a Friday, and there's a match last night, which we'll go into later, between England and Australia, and the grandstands were empty. The crowd looked woeful. So, yeah, looking forward to that chat later on in the pod.
Indeed. All right, well, let's get into it.
Let's go.
Hey, Greg, T20 Cricket World Cup. Finished during the week, wasn't it?
Or last weekend.
On the Sunday. So, semi-finals. Our last pod was around semi-final time. Look, a few upsets. So, New Zealand, 4 for 152, were defeated by Pakistan, who made 3 for 153. So, Pakistan won that by 7 wickets. And the other bigger surprise, well, not surprise, but India, 6 for 168. England made those runs in 0 for 170.
Yeah, I think it was the easy which they made the runs was the surprise with the England one. I thought that was going to be the closer of the semi-finals going in. That said, I expected New Zealand to win the other one, and they got done by Pakistan. So the one I thought would be close was probably the more lopsided, and the other one where I thought was a clear favourite end up losing. So it was interesting to see the semi-final results.
Yeah, starting with the New Zealand-Pakistan, we mentioned Pakistan, how they lost their first two games. And we spoke pre-tournament about how they can be hot and cold, but when they're on, they're on. And to their credit, they played really well, and you know, to force their way into the semis.
I think at that back end of the tournament where, you know, the mathematics, and they were a bit disappointing at the beginning, but they certainly, you know, had their run organised the right way and really played well when it counted.
Yeah, the bowlers did really well.
Particularly well, the bowlers, I agree with that.
New Zealand, unfortunately, who looked the team to beat, they saved their worst for last.
Yeah, that through the pool rounds, they were, as you said, they looked like the team to beat. They were consistently played well through all their pool matches.
Interesting to note that both teams who batted first got rolled. I know batting first in big games is, for many years, has been seen as the best way, you know, runs on the board in finals or semi-finals. But they both got chased down. Like 152 was never going to be enough.
No, it's pretty low score for international T20 these days.
And didn't quite fire. We'll talk about tactics, particularly of the India game. But Pakistan, yeah, really batted well also and deserved to make it through to the final. Now, India batted first, 6 for 168, as I said. Lucky to get that many. They were looking really dicey early with their run rate, but it's never, ever going to be enough.
No.
You know, against England, who are a great T20 team. But tactically, it was a little bit... I still, this is only my opinion, I still don't think some teams quite get T20. And what I mean by that is they lose a few wickets early and it becomes like a one-dayer. Okay, we need to consolidate.
Slow down. Take
some
time.
Work the ball around.
Get an established partnership going.
You get 20 overs. So, you know, after the power play, that happens, and then 6-7 overs just pass by, run a ball.
Even if you only go for 4 overs at run a ball, it's still, you know, a fifth of your overs gone. Yep. So, it's as you said, the T20 game's all over so quickly. You know, I wonder if there is time for that consolidation theory in the 20-over game.
Yeah, and I've said this to you a few times. My opinion is just send out one of the lower order who can score runs, big innings, just to have a crack.
Got nothing. Yeah, at that point, you've got nothing to lose. You know, at least get some runs on the board.
Two of those sort of batsmen, if You know, they score quick in five overs. They get out. Who cares? You know, on you go.
Yeah.
Because 168 was never going to be enough.
Pitch was good. It's pretty low score.
You know, So I think tactically teams do need to have a rethink of that. But credit to England. Alex Hales and Butler, Josh Butler, they had a field day.
All over it. All totally in control.
So well-deserved into the final at the MCG last Sunday. Well, the first surprise was the game went ahead because serious weather issues were expected and forecast.
A lot of rain around earlier on, wasn't there?
They actually expected, they had a Monday, they had a backup day scheduled.
I did read that. I didn't know that originally, but I did see there was, if it was a washout, they actually had a backup day.
They weren't talking about the Sunday, they were talking about Monday because that's how short they were. The whole thing wasn't going to go ahead on Sunday, but it didn't. It did go ahead. The rain eased off. I watched a bit of a T20 women's game from St Kilda Junction Oval and St Kilda on the Sunday, and I thought, well, okay, it's not raining. There are a chance here. And a few drops throughout the game, but they got it through it. So the result, Pakistan batted first, 8 for 137, which was never, ever going to be enough.
Like that's, we'd say 150, 160 is not enough. 130, whatever you just said, was never going to be competitive, sadly, for a World Cup final. Look,
England lost five, but a couple of them were late. They were two down for nearly that total, winning by 5 wickets. Not unexpectedly, and the history is there, Mr. Ben Stokes got England home. You know, came in, wickets, the openers went okay, but then wickets fell, and he steadied the ship. Look, having said that about Pakistan, it wasn't an easy pitch. So 137, it wasn't a terrible score, but like we said, it wasn't going to be enough. But England, you know, put their heads down and just got the job done. And once again, Pakistan, look, tactically they were okay. I don't think they didn't sort of, you know, because they lost wickets, they just did what they could. Some really good hitting by a few batters late. Well, sort of late, really late. I think they lost their way a little bit. But so I wouldn't say the game was a fizzer because England thoroughly deserved it. But England, yeah, got the job done, and you know they are the best T20 team in the world, really.
Haven't they been on that track for a while now? And really, as a English group, work towards that.
And you know, the last World Cup last year, which Australia won a bit unexpectedly, but England were back on song, and they're now the reigning one-day international and T20 World Cup champions. Look, so well done to our English friends. We have that great rivalry. We love getting stuck into them. But, yeah, take your hat off.
No, credit to them. I agree. We do love the rivalry between Australia and England, particularly all sports, but particularly cricket. But, you know, credit to them. They are, at the moment, by far the best team in the short form, both short forms of the game. And have worked long and hard to get there and well deserved.
And they have worked hard because it wasn't 10 years ago, approximately, they were the worst one day.
Dreadful.
Absolutely dreadful. And they, to their credit, they took stock, had a big, not an inquiry, but a discussion and put things in place, and now they're reaping the rewards. Now, India not making it. Look, obviously the final was always going to be like a sellout anyway, but yeah, that would have meant a few billion less viewers across the world would have watched it. But look, India, they made the semis, only one game away. They weren't disgraced in any way, shape or form. And
no, they're still a world powerhouse in all forms of the game. But they just don't quite get there in the World Cup the last few times.
No, as I mentioned, the tactics, yeah, pressure, isn't it? How much the pressure, you know, just of that, how many people are at home, you know, and all that. It is certainly something that I think as a player, if you thought about it too much, it would get to you.
Yeah, it's the national expectation from the Indian community for that team to perform well would be quite daunting,
like,
I would think.
You know, just to make that team, you know, out of the amount of people who, well, population of India and the amount of people who play cricket, to get there and to know that if you do well, you know, you're never going to have to work again. Basically, in your life these days, with the way the commercialism is. But on the other side of that, if you do badly or a team does badly.
Not even badly, but just doesn't win. Like the expectation is, of a billion people is you're going to win. And when you think about it, what other sports do India really perform in? It is by far and away their national sport.
Their national game and their national obsession and great love, isn't it? They do. There's not much else. Look, they're not a bad hockey team.
Good point. They're a very good hockey team, actually.
And in terms of, you know, soccer and football and things like that, there's not much else, is there?
No, there's not.
And you're right. I just wrapped them for getting that far. But make no mistake, in India, it would have been failure.
Would have been a fail. I agree. I think it would have been seen as a failure.
Which shows you the pressure they're under. But look, done and dusted. It was the 2021 World Cup because of the COVID and that. So done and dusted. Well done to England. You mentioned before, Greg, very briefly, Australia and England, really disappointing crowd last night. Overall, we're looking at the bigger picture and just thinking, you know, what is the future? So we're going to have a deep dive a little bit later. We'll have a look at the history of one day cricket and how it's changed and over the years and where it's going.
Yeah, certainly, and we'll bring this up later, but in our formative high school years, it was the number one, you know, summer pastime in Australia, where, you know, 50 over game World Series cricket, and we'll talk more about it, but couldn't look away and sell out crowds week in, week out.
It was cancel all engagements.
But it's just how times have changed, and just not just in Australia, but where does a 50 over game sit in the cricket world, in the cricket calendar? And yeah, we won't talk much about it now, but Australia did play England last night in Adelaide. Australia won comfortably, actually, as it turned out. England did rest a few of their players as a hangover from the World Cup,
unexpectedly.
2020 World Cup. So they did rest a number of their players. It wasn't really the first line, front line England team available. And I think they'll be stronger in Sydney on the weekend and then Melbourne on Tuesday.
Sure. Now, Greg, Rugby League World Cup. Now, the semi-finals were held last weekend. Did you watch Australia versus New Zealand?
I actually caught the second half.
Really good game.
Great game.
Australia 16 defeated New Zealand 14. Look, from the outset, it was really tough. Australia, we just find a way. New Zealand scored first. They looked really good with the ball in hand, attacking. Australia were quite clunky.
They didn't look great.
With the exception of the fantastic try to Adhokar.
Off the kick.
Brought back. It was, you know, Steve Guerin all those years ago in the Canterbury Grand Final. It was as good as that. Cross field, really high, and just timed it to perfection. Really, look, Australia defended really strongly. As the game progressed, New Zealand, the second half, I think only had one try.
And it was a really soft
try.
That was
the one to Cameron Murray. Yeah.
Cameron Murray, and I think New Zealand will rue that because that was it. It was very tight in that second half. As I said, I saw the second half live, and it was very close, except for that little mental breakdown where Cameron Murray ended up scoring a fairly soft try.
In comparison to the rest of the game, it very, very soft try. But New Zealand, the last 10 minutes, the fitness, Australia's fitness, I think, held them in good stead.
About to make the same comment. New Zealand, for that last 10 to 8 minutes, looked really tired on the field.
And I dare say, yes, obviously physical, but also a lot mental, because I'm sure they were thinking, we have thrown everything at this mob and still we cannot get through. And it just, you know, Australia just got it done. We, as I said, clunky in attack. I think it's fair to say that despite all our discussions, Nathan Cleary hasn't done a lot.
He was a bit disappointing. And look, you and I both, not Penrith fans, but both advocates, he should have been the halfback hands down, but it wasn't his best game. It hasn't been his best games.
No, and can be argued, with the exception of one or two last year, he hasn't really done the job at Origin either. True. But regardless of all that, Australia defended strongly, still scored enough points to win. They'll be definitely better for the run. Probably sounds like we've been a little bit critical, but sort of taking into account, they haven't had any hard games.
That's the problem with a Rugby League World Cup.
No sort of tough games in the lead-up. So
you've got those three or four really strong nations, and obviously they separate those across the pools. So you can't really get a really strong warm-up game.
No, so hence the clunkiness in attack, and, you know, the defence was great. I hate to give credit to referees, but well-refereed. I think Ashley Klein, you know, hardly sort of referred to him or saw him throughout. you know, which was good, and he's being rewarded with the final.
I was going to say he got the final, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so that game was held up in Leeds and Ellen Road, and the Yorkshire faithful, they got to see a great game. One thing, look, I love Vossie. I love Andrew Voss. But geez, he was starting to great. Vossie, you didn't need to tell us 50,000 times what a great game it was. We could see it. I don't know, were you listening to the commentary?
Yeah, and look, I'm not a huge Vossie fan. He grates on me a little bit.
Yeah, well,
to me, he's always trying to oversell how great rugby league is.
Yeah, we can see it.
I already like rugby league. I've switched on. I don't need to be told whether I think it's the greatest game in the world or not. I don't need to be told every other second that it's the greatest game. I've chosen to watch it. I've switched on. Give me some nuances about the game that I don't know.
Yeah, which is what?
But I'm with you a bit.
Yeah, like I said, I do like Vossie. I just like his quirkiness, and you just think, he's a tragic leaguey, you know, who's misspent youth going grounds all over Sydney town watching very ordinary games. Rugby league. I love his enthusiasm and all that, yeah, but Vossie, please, mate. We don't need to know every minute what a good game it is. We can see it. But anyway, as good as that was, did you see any of the highlights or?
Unfortunately, Samoa, I didn't. I know the score, but unfortunately, I missed it completely.
Yeah, if anyone missed it, so Samoa 27 defeated England 26 in Golden Point. A huge upset. Now, England were very heavily favoured. England flogged Samoa 60-6 in the first pool game.
First game, yeah.
Which, that's a turnaround, isn't it? Which does say a little bit, though. The draw was deliberately done to give England the best chance.
Of course it was. On their home, you know, they're paying the money to host
it. Well, the fact they're playing a team in their pool in the semi, how's that work?
Yeah, I don't know how the crossover. I don't know how the crossovers work. Why? Yeah, I don't understand how that was possible.
Anyway, but regardless, look, England heavily favourite, and they were playing really good footy to start with. But as we sort of predicted, that was always going to be the case, wasn't it? At home, Super League finished not that long ago. A few, you know, easy-ish games. But when it came to the one that counted, you know, that's not to say England played well.
And we did comment that Samoa were disappointing in that game and thought they would get better as the tournament went on. I don't know if I thought they'd get that much better.
Yeah, but remember I said I didn't wrap myself here.
You did?
But I wasn't willing to write them off yet.
You did. You were very clear. You thought they still had very strong chance.
I thought it was with interest to know. Remember I mentioned Andrew Webster unloaded on Matt Parrish? And we had a quick chat about that. And I thought that was a little bit, it was un-Andrew Webster like, who I like as a journalist.
A bit harsh.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether there's history there, but yeah, he just gave it to him deluxe. But now Matt Parrish is having the last laugh. So, you know, coaching a team to the World Cup final. Yeah, but Samoa's credit, look, it was tit for tat. You know, England in front. I think the lead changed six times in the last 20 minutes or something. It was, and in the end, it was Stephen Crichton who, with form, took an intercept late in the game to get it the scores level. And then he kicked the field goal. Not known for his field goal kicking.
No, credit to him.
A field goal when it mattered in the Golden Point. Yeah, look, obviously England were shattered because they, in their heart of hearts, they thought they were going to the finals.
They expected to be.
When they saw they were playing Samoa, they were thinking, here we go, finals time. But unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. Look, the crowd from, I didn't see the official figure. This one was in London at the Emirates Stadium, Arsenal's home ground. Wasn't sold out, but looked quite healthy. And the fact, interesting though, why England, they got England to play there.
You think in the north,
you
one
think
of the
sold out
biggest
game
stadiums.
Well, I guess when they use Wembley, it nearly sells out. So, yeah, but whoever went was certainly treated to a wonderful game of rugby league. Now, I didn't, as I said, I only saw highlights. And I'm sure if you commentated, Vossie would have told us how good it was.
I have no
doubt.
5 million
times. But yeah, congratulations, Samoa. And look, great to see them in the final. Around here, Campbelltown, not far from where I live, big Samoan community. There's flags everywhere. You drive around and there's people with the flag out of their car. Oh, it's just great. You know, great for their community and just a wonderful, wonderful result. But having said that, the final, I'm not sure what your thoughts are, mate, but I think Australia will probably win comfortably in the end.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, somewhere between 10 and 16 point win would be my guess.
Samoa have a very good forward pack. And also, particularly with Jerome Luai, good halves and handy outside backs, it won't be a walkover. And there's no way Samoa will be thinking, oh, you know, final, great. We're lucky just to get there.
I agree with you. I think Samoa will be
in it to win it, for sure.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you with that. I don't think just making the final is what they will consider successful. They actually plan on winning and going in winning. Look, as you said, I think Australia will win comfortably, but I don't think it'll be one of those massive walkovers.
No, I think the first 20 minutes will be great. There'll be a hell of a softening up period. Yeah. Junior Bolos, some say lucky to play, but I didn't think there was much in it. He's sin-binning. It was a dangerous. He got him high, but they dropped him. You know, they didn't drop him gently. I thought it was fair enough that he wasn't made to miss a game for that. So they'll be at full strength. Look, Australia, I haven't seen the team announced, but I don't think there'll be any changes.
I did see it this morning, actually, and I don't think there are any changes.
Not surprised there. To my son, who's a huge Cowboys fan, he was not happy that Reuben Cotter wasn't there and Liam Martin was in for him. And, of course, Liam Martin had a blinder, 1 man of the match.
Yes, I think Liam's going to be disappointed again when he sees the team list.
He is, but no, Reuben Cotter can hold his head high regardless. But, yeah, so that is at Old Trafford, 3 a.m., awful time. So I won't be watching it live.
I won't be watching it live either. I was about to say I'll be catching a replay.
Beauty of these days, isn't it, with the minis and the highlights and that, very easy. You can access the highlights up as soon as you're ready to. But sold out, I would hope, at Old Trafford. Look, just a great buzz to get to play on Old Trafford. You know, most of the Australian players have never played there. A few of the older ones, maybe once or twice. But yeah, I know Nathan Cleary's a huge Man United fan, so he's obviously stoked to get the hallowed turf.
Very special just to be there.
Just be a great event. And there'll be plenty of crowd support. It'll be interesting to see. A lot of the supporters will be neutrals. They'll probably go for the underdog, I imagine.
A lot of the English will go for Samoa just because they're against Australia and they're the underdog, I would say.
Yeah, so really looking forward to that. Good luck to both teams. Also, in those who, some rugby league tragics, who will stay up for it, well, Sunday at the previous game at 12:15 a.m, just after midnight, is the women's final, Australia versus New Zealand.
Which Australia have romped in.
Yeah, although they narrowly beat New Zealand in the lead-up.
Yes, sorry, that's right.
Look, I suspect Australia, just being Australia, will probably do it a lot easier in this, but you never know, do you?
You never know in a final. I agree with you. I think the Australian women will get up, and they'll get up somewhat comfortably. Like, a bit like the men's, the first 20 minutes, 15 minutes will be tough.
And then after that...
But I think the Gillaroos will end up with a win.
I think so too. But hey, you never know. Anything's possible in a final. NRL news, well, sort of related to the World Cup. Very briefly, Greg. Interesting chat for another time. But yeah, talk of an Australia should field an Indigenous team at the next World Cup.
I saw this in the news yesterday, and I don't know how I feel
about
it.
I'll
say that as a huge advocate for Indigenous players and Indigenous rights on a personal level, but I don't know how it would work 100%. You know, if you've one of the best Indigenous players, do you get to choose you? If you're eligible and good enough to be played in the Australian team, do you have to choose between that and the Australian Indigenous team? I'm not sure how it would all work. And look, that's part of the conversation.
Like something that potentially, it's designed to be a great inclusive thing, can actually be quite divisive because of what you just said.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, but I think it's definitely worth debating at some stage. Be great, wouldn't it? It would probably turn out to be, I personally think the only way it would work, it would have to be Indigenous team of the next best. So any Indigenous player who's in the top 17 plays for Australia, and then Indigenous team out of
But then the argument would be, could you not have an Australia B team?
Yeah, that's
play?
Right. Where do you draw the line?
So, I think it's a healthy conversation to have, and there's certainly a plethora of amazing Indigenous players. I'm certainly not saying they wouldn't be competitive if they did use that model. I think they would be competitive. But where does it all stand? And then New Zealand could have a different, could have a similar conversation.
New Zealand, around their Maori, Indigenous New players. Zealand, Polynesian team, yeah. But not the worst. Look, it just started as a conversation, I guess, to fill newspaper and clickbait, but worth having a chat about at a later stage.
Definitely.
Now, NRL news. My mob always in the news, the West Tigers. Look, they've released Jackson Hastings. I think he had another year to go on his contract. He's gone to Newcastle on a 3-year deal. And David Clemmer has gone to the Tigers on a 3-year deal. Now, as a Tigers fan, I'm stoked. I'll be honest about it. Look.
Okay. I was wondering how you feel
as much
about
as Hastings.
Because he hasn't.
Look, Jackson Hastings, as a what he bought in attitude, as much as on the field. I thought, yeah, you know, Man of Steel in the Super League. He offered a bit. End of the day, though, he's just not good enough. When I say not good enough, he's a first grader, but he's just not. He is what he is when he left. A bloke that's tried a few clubs. He's just not up to it at the elite level, I don't think.
Bit of a journeyman.
Yeah, journeyman. And I think some people are thinking that he's going to go to that next level. I think I saw enough to say, no, I don't think so.
That said, how do you feel about David Clemmer, who I don't think's performed particularly well last year in Newcastle and getting towards the end of his career? And he has been successful over time. I appreciate that. But he's certainly at the back end of his career.
Back end of his career. I disagree a little bit, Greg. I think he's been, the last 2 years, he's played really well for them.
Okay.
A little bit right. Out of sight, out of mind.
Maybe.
Up there. I think he's played as well as he was when he was getting picked in the rep teams. His discipline has improved. Look, I personally, you know, front rowers are pretty, a good front rower is a pretty rare and hard to find.
That is also true. I appreciate
Mind
that.
You, yeah. Being the Tigers, it's amazing how blokes just lose ability once they walk through the gates at Leichhardt Oval or Concord or wherever. But look, yeah, if fit, I think potentially, yeah. I'm not unhappy.
Okay, that's good. As a fan, it's good to hear that you're...
And happy more so that they're actually building a decent forward pack. As someone alluded to, though, yeah, but their problems are a little bit deeper than that.
I was going to say, I think
outside backs are an issue, but
a few other issues that need
but
to
anyway,
be addressed rather than just the forward pack.
That's a chat for another day. Look, very briefly, Victor Radley, who controversially played for England in the World Cup, was involved. I'm not over it in any way, but I just heard about it. Some sort of altercation.
Pub or nightclub incident.
Dude, that's never happened before in the rugby league world.
No. Who would have thought,
now,
right?
And something I won't harp on, Greg, because you know that annoys me. But Newcastle are looking for a fullback, chasing a fullback, because they're apparently going to this playing Caelan Ponga at 5'8 thing. Well, why wouldn't they? Because it worked so well last time.
Yeah, it seems like a conversation that's already been had and an option that's been tried. He's an amazing player, but he's brilliant at fullback. Why change him to something else? Why not go and find a great 5'8"? What, do they think there's more fullbacks out there to choose from?
Well, I guess technically they probably are right. Proper 5'8"s are very hard to find. But yeah, he proved that it just didn't work. I guess Newcastle are going by the theory, if you don't succeed, try again. Maybe with a few more years under his belt, but I just does my head in. Why do they do that? And if they're thinking, yes, yeah, so they got Hastings in, oh, you know, I'm not sure what it says to you know, their up-and-coming fullbacks at the Knights, but anyway, that's what they're looking to do. So Knights, you know, I'm happy to have egg on my face down the track. We'll see how it goes next season. Greg, the other rugby code, rugby union, the Wallabies are on their annual Northern Hemisphere tour, whatever they call it, the spring tour.
Spring tour, I think it is.
Now, yeah. As you know, Australia, our Wallabies have been up and down and struggling a bit. So the tour, and there's been a fair bit of controversy, haven't they, with selections and who's on the tour, who's not. So it started with a very scratchy 16-15 victory over Scotland. And let's be honest, Scotland are not a powerhouse.
They're not a superpower, no.
But there are six Nations team. Then I thought I saw improvement. A really entertaining match. France, 30, defeated Australia, 29. But Australia, we threw the ball around a bit. Some really good tries. Just a good game of rugby. Dare I say, a bit of rotting rugby here and there.
Nice to see again, isn't it?
So I thought the signs were good. But then, last weekend, rested or dropped, whatever you want to say, but tried 7 or 8 new players and paid the penalty. Italy, 28, defeated Australia, 27. That's a... Let's be honest, no disrespect for Italy, but that's an embarrassing result.
That is. Italy are not a world superpower in rugby.
Yeah, you know, they have improved, you know, being in the Six Nations and that, a lot better than they were, say, 20 years ago, but still.
But still a second tier.
No, very.
Rugby level.
Well, for two counts, losing, like, you know, this is not a, they're wearing Australian jumper, for goodness sake.
That's exactly right.
And not surprisingly, a lot of pressure on coach David Rennie. Let's face it, the Australian Rugby Union coaching job, it, in the last 20 years, it's never been a secure source of employment.
Talk about a poison pill taking on the Wallabies coaching, as you said, over the last decade at least.
But anyway, two games to go. So against Ireland, who are number one ranked team in the world at the moment.
I was going to say they're very strong. So that'll be a real test to see how...
And Wales, which is never, ever at the Millennium Stadium a pushover either. So we'll see how they go over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Look, Wallabies, look, I know, you know, it can be very frustrating for their supporters, but, you know, hopefully something. Look, at the end of the day, next year's World Cup is what it's all, every team's building
They are building towards, there's a home World Cup in Australia. They are certainly building towards a good performance there. So it's all a work in progress, I guess, in their head, in their mind, in the powers that be, Australian rugby mind. It's a work in progress. So we'll see where they go.
Well, indeed. Brief AFL news. Look, very sad news, Greg. You might have heard during the week. A former AFLW player for the Adelaide Crows, Heather Anderson, passed away during the week. Unfortunately took her own life. So, look, our condolences to all Heather's friends and family. Yeah, look, but the AFL world have really gathered around their family. It's a conversation... Well, type of incident is all too common, as we've chatted about before. But, yeah, so really feel for Heather's family. And as always, you know, anyone listening, you know, please, if you are struggling, you're not alone, just get the help that's available. Lifeline, Beyond Blue, all those sort of great organisations. And the other thing of interest, Greg, call from some pundits and a few ex-players for a Brownlow medal voting change. The Brownlow, as most people know, it's equivalent to the Al Roughlins medal, so it's the on-field officials, the umpires, it's their 3-2-1 votes is how it's calculated. And a few of them are saying, well, I think that system is sort of, it's not appropriate in today's day and age. What do you think?
I tend to agree. I think if there's a lot of pressure on referees/umpires with video refs and, you know, being challenged around their calls all the time. They've got to, and they're amazing athletes themselves. They've got to be fit. They've got to be, you know, on top of their game to perform
certainly,
at that level.
Even more so every year. It gets quicker.
So to have the added pressure of looking and judging the quality of play and not just interpreting the rules, I think it's a bit of an outdated view if you want your referees/umpires at the top of their game for every game, and they should be. So I'm all in favour of changing that. I don't think there's a place for them to be voting on the players.
And also, that was, you know, many years that was the old 2-umpire system. I think now there's 3 field umpires. So they're not getting around and seeing everything either. I'm not sure how it actually works, their voting. They confer and it's just a 3-2 and all that. But yeah, I just think the speed of the game these days. But quite rightly, the other side of the coin, you can argue. So it just becomes a media stroke expert voting. Again, it doesn't matter whether it's umpires or media people, whoever. They're always going to be favourite. They're always going to have players that are well known and tend to get votes. You know, just because of people half think, oh yeah, they played okay.
Could it be and I'm just throwing this out there, could it be a coach's vote, but you're not allowed to vote for a player on your own team?
Something like that. Yeah, there is a...
And I only say that because they'd be looking at the game as a whole and have an expertise in not just the popular definitely. Names.
It's funny you say that, Greg, because Nathan Buckley was one of them who's been commenting on this, and he did a tweet, and he just said, look, as an ex-player and coach, he ranked the importance he sees of the awards. And I think he said number one, as always, with the players, is the Players Association, best player. I think he said two was the Coaches Award, the Coaches Association. Brownlow, he ranked third.
And I'm not surprised to hear a former player slash coach say that either.
One thing the AFL, as we know, do love is their tradition. So nothing changes with
nothing changes quickly with the AFL.
Yeah, so I can't see any change in the foreseeable future, but I think it's a good conversation.
I think it's a great conversation and a timely conversation to have.
And regardless, you know, whoever wins the Brownlow, it's a hell of an achievement. Soccer World Cup, just a minor competition, Greg, the biggest sporting event in the world, apart from the Olympics, every 4 years. Look, I was going to do a bit of a preview, but everything else happening, it's sort of time has just passed too quickly. So, soccer fans, what we're going to do, we don't want to be disrespectful. So, I don't even have my head around the groups or anything. I know it kicks off this weekend, is that right?
Yeah, so I think we'll, you know, let it start and sort out the pools, and then we'll have a bit of a deeper look at the World Cup maybe next Friday.
This time next week, I'll only be one or two games in, so we'll be able to have a decent preview. Greg, NBL. The NBL season is well and truly up and running.
So we've just had a two-week break for a FIBA window. There's been World Cup qualifiers going on around the world, and the NBL, like most leagues, shut down for a couple of weeks to have those FIBA games so the players can go and represent their country. That said, the NBA don't stop, and that's why you find none of the top players playing in America actually go and play for their nations in the FIBA window. Australia was scheduled to play two games, both away on this window, one in Kazakhstan and then in Iran. Now, they won the Kazakhstan game very comfortably by 50 points, which guaranteed them qualification for the World Cup next year, so they've now qualified. And based on the local unrest and government advice, they chose not to travel to Iran and actually forfeited that game.
Probably not the worst idea in the world.
Now, FIBA's said they're looking into any other repercussions of that, which there's been a bit of media outrage over. When your government says advice not to travel, why is an sporting organisation even putting it out there? There may be other repercussions. I don't think much will come of it, but the fact that it's even conversation is a bit sad. But they have qualified for World Cup next year, which will be held in Indonesia, the Philippines and Japan. It's been jointly hosted by three nations. Mm. And you'll find that the Americans and NBA Australians, etc., will be available for those teams from around the world for that. But the warm-up, the qualification games, they don't play for. So the NBL came back again, played two games last night. Melbourne United lost to Adelaide, and Perth beat South East Melbourne as we get back into that after a short break. The other bit of NBL news was something that would have been very challenging, I'm sure, for the individual, but it's been very positive outcome, is Isaac Humphries, who's an Australian player, plays for Melbourne United, a centre, came out as being a openly gay, the first professional Australian basketballer to do that, and confronted his team. He made a bit of a video promo of it, and came across, you know, gave a bit of his personal stories and the struggles he's had personally with coming to the decision around his sexuality, and has decided that, you know, part of his role is going to be as a bit of a role model that you can be whoever you want and still be a great sports person. Sure. Very much aligned with Ian Roberts in the rugby league many years ago now. And I have no doubt, you know, for Isaac, that would have been a very tough decision to do it in the public way he did it. But kudos to him. The club is supportive, the team is supportive, and the NBL as an organisation is openly supportive. And I think I made the comment to you, I think it says a lot for basketball in Australia that he felt comfortable enough and supported by the organisation, but the sport and the league in general, that he could make such a high-profile comment and feel so comfortable
doing it. And the sporting public as well. I think it's been very well received.
So kudos to him, and I laugh about the, you know, the small-mindedness, in my opinion, of the Manly players and their pride not wearing the coloured stripes. I noticed Melbourne United had specially designed rainbow T-shirts with their Melbourne logo, but a rainbow around it, and they're all wearing it without comment. So kudos to the league, Isaac in particular, and Melbourne United for the support moving forward around genuine inclusivity.
For sure. And as you said, it would have been a bit of a quandary for him, you know, how he wanted to do it, and then, you know, well, A, if to do it, and then how to do it. But I thought, yeah, it was really well done, and it's been definitely positively received.
Absolutely. Really, really well done. The other thing I'll say about basketball is the WNBL's just started. I think we're going to round three this week.
How's that looking?
The standard of the women's basketball is phenomenal. And if you get a chance to catch it on Fox or Nine Now, streaming service.
I see it on Fox every now and again.
Fox, KO on Fox is showing it, but Nine Now show it on free to air on their streaming service. It's just coming off the back of the World Cup, the women's game in Australia is really strong. The sad thing is the first 2 weeks, particularly the first week, the coverage, the product they put on TV was appalling. The scores were wrong. The times were wrong. Perth who play in red looked like they were literally wearing pink. It just, the quality of the on the screen product was appalling. But credit to the WNBL, they acknowledged it and worked with their provider, and it has got better next. So it is improving. It just was, the product was amazing, but the way it was presented was appalling. And that didn't really meet why the women were
in today's day and age. You've got to get that right, don't you?
Absolutely. So it is improving. The second week was better, and week three, which started this week, was even better again. So the WL has obviously worked with their media provider, who I don't know who provides their telecast, who that's contracted to, but you can see improvements in it. So if you get a chance to catch of the WNBL, highly recommend it. Townsville are performing really well. Bendigo Spirit, really playing well, and they've still got Tess Madgen to come back. She's injured. She's the captain of the Opals and is injured coming back. And of Southside Flyers with Lauren Jackson playing up there as well. So
never going to be a never going to do any harm.
Melbourne Boomers are really good, and it's nice to see the Opals spread across the teams. They're not, no team is really loaded with Opals. They've spread across the teams. So yeah, really good high quality basketball in the women's competition. So if you get a chance, flick it on for a bit, because it's really good quality basketball. And I will say the crowds are up, their live in-person crowds up tremendously. I'm going to say on the back of the World Cup and all those players from the Opals being in the local team, or most of them, not everyone, a couple are in Europe, but most of them are playing locally. So to get out to see those games, they made a real concerted effort to be available to fans after games for photos, sign autographs. So they're doing a really good job promoting the game as well. So kudos to the players, the league and the organisation. It's going really well. If we get the TV right, it's an awesome product.
Good. And hopefully, you know, onwards trajectory continues. Good segue, Greg. The hoops, onto the hoops. So quick US sports update. So we'll start, obviously, with the NBA.
Yeah, well, the Lakers are still a disaster. They have won 3 games, but I think they're 3-8.
3-8, so not great.
Sitting at the bottom of the Western Conference. But there's a couple of other teams that should be performing better than they are. Philadelphia, very disappointing at the moment. They're hovering. I think they're about not quite at 500 at the moment. They're a bit below, but looking better and better each week. The Nets, the Nets, just a disaster zone. They are a circus with Kyrie. Chaos happening in the background and suspended, although there is talk he's coming back, if not the next game, the one after. But they just got smashed by 40-odd by Sacramento, who are traditionally a disaster case, and beat them comfortably. Durant's doing it on his own. Ben Simmons is coming off the bench, not even starting, but he's showing signs of improvement. A long way to go to the old Ben Simmons, but he's certainly showing signs of improvement.
I bet you one player who's still having a go.
Well,
Patty Mills
has fallen out of the rotation, which I do not understand.
He's not getting any run.
He's getting very limited minutes at the moment. So I don't know what's going on with Brooklyn. But on the other end, Phoenix are playing really well. And we've got an Australian backup center, Jock Landale, plays for Phoenix and scored 22 against the Gold State Warriors yesterday.
Awesome.
Playing really well, putting in really good time and getting a lot of media coverage and comment around the addition. So he got traded from San Antonio to Phoenix in the offseason, and his minutes have skyrocketed and really found a place. I think he's fallen on his feet and getting really good run and really adding to the
team.
Great
for him. I didn't even realise that Dellavedova was back in the NBA.
Yeah, he's been picked up as a veteran playing for Sacramento. Well, he's not getting many minutes, but I think his coach, Mike Brown, coached him when he was in Cleveland. So they've got a bit of a history. And I think Brown really rates Dellavedova and brought him in as very much that veteran locker room, let's get the culture right. Because one of the problems with Sacramento, the culture has been a nightmare, been a joke of the NBA.
Many years, haven't it?
many, many years. So I think they signed Mike Brown as a new coach with a good resume, and he just brought Dellavedova back. He had a relationship with him and knew the culture.
You got to get that right first, don't you?
He would bring as a veteran on the team. So I think Deli knew he wasn't going to get a lot of run, but there to really build up, you know, they've got a lot of young and they're good players. So if they get that culture right, which I think he's there for, and so far they're playing well and in the middle of the Western Conference. So big improvement for where they've been.
Well done to them.
One of our other is Josh Giddey. Scored another triple-double in Madison Square Garden. And really, they love their bizarre stats in America, but there's been only one other player that scored a triple-double on their first two appearances at Madison Square Garden, and that was Wilt Chamberlain.
A legend.
So they've even been... Even to be... Yeah,
in that company.
In that sentence is phenomenal. So, you know, Josh is really finding his feet in a very... You know, good league and performing amazingly well for the OKC, which is a rebuilding team. You know, they're not good, very young. As I think I called them young and dumb a couple of weeks ago, they are young and dumb, but they're heading in the right direction, and they're certainly going to be a team of the future. So yeah, that's a bit of a run around the grounds. Golden State Warriors aren't performing; they still haven't run one on the road. Actually, they're 0-8 for away games at the moment, so they're still finding their feet going into this season. So.
We'll check in again.
Yeah, check in again, particularly with I do like following the Aussies in the NBA. Two young Aussies performing really well. Josh Green for Dallas really getting some minutes. His third season and really starting to find his role in the team and performing really well. Dyson Daniels, the rookie for New Orleans, and he's starting to get a few minutes as well and playing quite well. Yeah, so now the Aussies performing really well where they're getting a chance
to. The future's looking good, isn't it?
Really strong. It's amazing, actually. Yeah.
NFL, Greg, moving along. Your team had a win. Pittsburgh.
Good to hear.
Had a win, but some not just interesting, but really great results. Game of the season so far. Minnesota and Buffalo, you know, who are both was five or six wins on board, and it was 33-30 Minnesota won in overtime. It was just. Lead the last quarter, so many lead changes again. It was.
I haven't watched after that. Watched
was raving about it, my son, and I went and watched the highlights. It was just a great game.
Go back and watch that one now. I haven't watched that one.
And things happened that hardly ever happened. I think the goal kicker missed one from about 20 yards out in front and all sorts of things. But it was just, yeah, a fantastic game. So, and Buffalo, look, they're still one of the teams to beat, but they've lost two in a row now. They're down to 5-2, but yeah. So the Vikings, they are very high. That they're flying, as are Philadelphia, who are 8-1. They did lose a game, but the New York teams, a few of them didn't play on the weekend. But 7-2, the Giants. Yeah, Minnesota 8-1, which is good. Detroit managed a win, which is very rare. But them and fellow NFC North. Rivals, the Bears, they played each other, and Detroit got the money there. And yeah, it's funny though. I think we mentioned this last time. There's some conferences where the leader of the conference is like a 5-5. Tampa Bay are 5-5 and leading, whereas others, you know, teams are nearly that many games are on the bottom. So, but I guess that's the way of the conference system. Yeah. So my team, the Bengals, had a bye, and Baltimore had a bye last week, but yeah, it's moving forward. It's looking forward. The next month is going to be crucial.
Quite serious, you reckon? Yeah.
It's the NFL. And then lastly, with the North American report, the baseball, Houston Astros are the World Series champions. Always laugh about the World Series. All of the US and one Canadian team. But anyway, yes, I think 4-2 in the end. They were just too good over Philly. But Philadelphia had a great season just to make it that far. Yeah, Houston, it was just like I said, Philly looked good early, but then they hit a bad spot where they went two games without even getting someone on base or home or something. So they sort of ran out of puff. Look, for Houston, second one in about 5 years. This one I think will be a little bit tarred, the previous one. I don't know if you recall, but they actually got fined heavily later. They basically cheated. It was to do with pitching calls and somehow coverage on the TV getting the message through. It was, I don't know the full facts, but
it was basically
somehow they were doing something where the batter was knowing what pitch was coming. But anyway, and because it was all after the event, I'm not sure how bad it was.
They didn't get stripped of their title. They just got fined. Okay.
But this one, I'm sure, is all above board.
Look, they played well. I did watch some of the games. They played well and dominated over Philly in the end. But as you said, Philly had a great season, even slipped through into the World Series as it was. So credit to Philly. But Houston were the standout in that final series. They were stronger by far.
Yeah, so well done to the Astros. Really, really strong team.
Yeah.
Now, Formula One, Greg, I wasn't all over this, but our Australian Daniel Ricciardo, the poor bugger, he just cannot take a trick at the moment.
Shock and end, isn't it? And he's not racing. He's basically said he won't be in racing next year. So it's kind of... he's talking about taking a year out and coming back, but you don't know at his age whether that's going to be viable in the end. But he's had a terrible season. In the last race, caused a crash, which took him out, and whoever he crashed into took them out as well. If it wasn't the first, it was a very early lap, and a nightmare.
First lap, so the dreaded D did not finish. Just when things are it's like form and that, isn't it? When things aren't going your way, they're not going your way.
Just the season's gone from bad to worse for the poor guy, and he's such a nice guy, and always said how well liked he is on the circuit by the other drivers, very popular colleagues. So it's a real, if it is the end, it's a real sad way for him to finish. So I hope he either does, somehow end up with a ride somewhere next year, if not in 2024, to finish his career on positive.
And let's be honest about it. It is a sport where good blokes aren't that easy to find. Egos. Not saying they're bad blokes, I guess, but huge egos.
Keep your ego under control. That's right.
In that sport. And he's very down to earth, very approachable.
Seems to be.
Just those sort of, dare I say, Australian qualities. But yeah. Bit of a shame for Daniel, but hopefully, next year or two, things pan out for him a lot more positively. So. Greg, I think we're done.
I think we're done for a quiet period in sport. There's a lot to talk about.
World Cups do that. So please join us. We'll be back very shortly with our deep dive looking at the future of one-day international cricket. For our dive, as we mentioned previously, we're going to have a chat about one-day international cricket, 50-50. Often referred to these days. Greg's mentioned the crowds falling the last 5 years, Greg?
At least, probably a bit longer, but at least the last 5 years.
The popularity, which was there in previous years, has just really dropped off for various reasons. So we thought we'd just have a chat. Probably start with the history of it and just how it's changed over time. Now, internationally, I think the first... Look, I think limited overs... Start England County, I think they used to play probably in the 60s, some small, less over games rather than two or three day games. I think the first international, believe it or not, was they decided after a test was rained out or a day that they'd actually play a game for the spectators. Who would have thought? Looking after the spectators.
Something just for the crowd.
And, whether it was 40 or 50 overs... And I know Australia's first one-day international, believe it or not, was captained by Mr. Bill Laurie.
I did not realise that, really. Morris.
And they won, I believe. So Bill Laurie, ironically, known as one of the slowest accumulators of runs in cricket history, was a winning one-day captain. But yeah, look, early 70s really took off with Kerry Packer and the World Series cricket. But first World Cup was 1975. In England, but that slightly different. The first few World Cups were still in normal white clothing, red play with red ball, and they were 60 overs.
Yeah, I was going to say, I knew it was 60 over, and I knew it was a red ball. I knew it was all day matches. The whole day-night coloured clothing came in with the Kerry Packer.
Yes, he brought that in.
World Series cricket in Australia.
Traditionalists at the time thought it was didn't like it. People started to warm to it, I think, because it was a result in the one day, and the fact is it did lend itself to some more aggressive batting, particularly. Back then, though, it was very basic. No field restrictions, I don't think.
Was there a bowling limit?
There was a bowling limit. I think then when it started, it was 12 overs each. Up to five bowlers or more. But maximum was 12 overs. World Cup, look, West Indies were dominant. And then as we've both alluded to, the World Series cricket started, where Kerry Packer brought the coloured uniforms in. They really tailored to the viewers, particularly younger viewers.
It was very much a TV product. He obviously been the owner of Channel 9 in Australia and loved cricket himself. But felt the viewers weren't getting a fair deal and was very anti the establishment on the back of players not being paid very well either. Was his way in through his wallet by offering players a rebel league, it was basically at the time.
It was.
A rebel competition.
All he wanted was to show it, and he was willing to, I don't know if you saw that mini-series about it.
Yeah, I did. How's that, yes.
Where he was willing to work with the ACB, but they were just not, didn't want to know
about
it.
Pushed back every time he approached them.
And some people would be surprised to know that Richie Beno was very highly involved with Kerry Packer as well. Because Richie's, you know, held in such high esteem, people, particularly younger people, don't realise that he was quite anti-establishment at times. And this was certainly one of those cases. But yeah, they got it off the ground, showing the product, and made it much more visually attractive, engaging for people. Night cricket, and a major turning point for that was the night cricket.
Yeah, when they introduced where people could finish work and still go to the game during the weekday and pretty much see the whole game of an evening, that really was a game changer.
To us, it's something we take for granted. But back then, that was huge. Cricket was always played, you know, during the day, hot sun, particularly in Australia, during the day. If people wanted to go and watch it, that was fine, but they had to be prepared. Facilities weren't as good in those days for a long, hot day in the sun. You know, you had to write your whole day off. Whereas brought in, like you said, the day-night cricket, do your day's work, head down at 5 o'clock and watch, as you said, nearly a whole game.
Pretty much three quarters of the game and still get a result at the end.
And also, and just under lights, it just looks so much better. Yeah, you know, quite just the way it looks visually under lights, and because it was new and people found it exciting, didn't they? And from the old, sometimes seen as stodgy, you know, 5-day test cricket.
Well, test cricket at the time was slow. It wasn't as aggressive as it is now.
No.
So the games often were slow, often went the 5 days and still no results. So you invested a lot of time and still didn't get a result per se. Whereas the way one-day cricket was designed, or 50-over cricket, was you had to have a result. They couldn't, or you could get a tie, I guess, couldn't you?
You could get a tie, or, you know, rain, no result, but otherwise it was always a result. Whereas the test cricket, and back then, test cricket, they still had a rest day and stuff like that.
That's right. It was actually over 6 days because you had the rest day.
Yeah, so very long and drawn out. And as you mentioned, tactically, weren't particularly aggressive, and it just wasn't a great viewing product. Here comes this product, all in one day, a lot of it under lights, just getting a lot more people interested in cricket. And the end of the day, I think telling in that series was at the end where they do the day-night game at Sydney, and there's always people lined up without tickets or whatever, and Kerry Packer says, let them in.
Open the gates.
They just want to watch cricket. And I think today we forget that. That's what it was. It was all these people that just love cricket, getting a chance to watch it, to watch more of it, and in a fashion that they found appealing.
And certainly at that era, and we're talking about the 80s at this period of time, crowds compared to test matches were astronomical. Oh. They weren't getting the crowds at test matches at the time. It was all about one-day cricket.
All about, because previously mentioned, the way tests were played. And for the younger people who found test cricket boring, all in a day, exciting, the colours, the big hitting. Obviously, a amount of runs they'd accumulate in 50 overs was a lot more than you'd ever get in 50 overs of a test match. You know, the aggression, the characters who played as well. You know, it was a golden era for Australia and the West Indies.
A few personalities, yeah.
It was just a great time where everyone wanted to be part of it and wanted to watch it. And through the great work of Packer and the Nine Network, they televised it really well, didn't they?
They did.
A great product. Commentators who were, you know, not long out of the game.
At the time, they weren't long out of the game. And
same commentators 40 years later, but that's another story. very insightful. Yeah, and the best players, you know, Tony Greig and Blakes, who were the, you know, captain of England and former Test captains, and so a good package, overall package, entertainment package. So it was set up really well. And we went to school in the 80s, Greg. 80s, all through the 90s. A lot of us, it's what we watched. It was cancel all engagements. If one day it was on a Sunday, well, you knew you weren't doing a lot.
That's outside right. If those Australia hours. Were playing a one day on a Sunday in summer, that's where you were watching it.
A day game, you'd be there for about 10, they used to start. Yep. I remember sleeping in on a Sunday and knowing 9:30, oh, good, only 20 minutes. The coverage would start at 10:02 with the toss and all that, and into it by 10 o'clock. And it was always just looking forward, you know, to the big hitting and, you know, not the boring test match style of play. And the cricket public were happy to watch it. 80s, 90s. Well, I still think a fair bit of the 2000s.
Early 2000s, first half of the 2000s, definitely.
It was just standard, yep. Good, when the tests are over, we can get into the one-dayers. And, you know, they used to have the Bench and the Hedges Cup in Australia. Always had a final series of that.
It was always a tri-series. They always brought in, yeah, there's always three teams, three countries in Australia plus two others.
More often than not, New Zealand got lots of gigs in that because just because it was so easy, just bring them over. And it was generally, wasn't it, a lot of the time New Zealand and whoever the touring test team was. But often also two other countries as well. Yeah, and it was just so much more exciting than what test cricket was throwing up at that stage. And so that, about 25 years or more, the establishment, it was widely watched, big gate receipts, as I said, huge advertising dollars. It, you know, and not just that, the World Cups were becoming more popular. Wherever they were held, it was big dollars. And it was just something that everyone wanted to watch. But nothing lasts forever.
Now along came 2020.
2020.
And that shortened the game even, as opposed to having to give up a whole day, you only give up about 3 hours and see a result.
This is not to wrap 2020, but at the time, traditionalists with one-dayers, I've mentioned this before, my dad, I was young and I was always loved it. Dad always says, it's crap. Results don't mean anything, you know, just the way they play it, it's boring, it's formulaic. No. And later on, it's like, you know, when someone says to you about another person or something or anything, oh, this annoys me about that. And something that's never annoyed you before, when you're made aware of it, you sit and go, yeah, you're right. Sort of a bit like that. So it was 2020 came in and people realised, well, hang on, one day cricket, they have the field up for the first 15 overs. That could be exciting. Mind you, for half the time they had that, no one was brave enough to, you know, sort of take advantage of those. Probably Australia to some extent, Sri Lanka, when they sort of were late 90s.
Yeah, I think Sri Lanka might have even pipped Australia for that really attacking go early, go hard, go early strategy.
Jaya Saria and the wicketkeeper, forget his name, Kala Wafana or something like that, his name was. They sort of, yeah, they were instrumental in that. But then after the 15 overs, it was just a yawn fest.
Until about the last 8 overs.
About the last 7-8 overs. And at the time, I didn't realise that. And I remember going to see a game at the MCG and really, like I remember Stuart Law came in the bat. And because they dropped the field back after 15 overs, they just worked the ball around for 3 or 4 runs and over. And you looked up and Stuart Law was 70. And if you hadn't seen the game, oh, he's batting well. But really, you know, any decent first-class cricketer with those fields could probably have scored those runs. No offence to Stuart Law. Just the way it was played. So in essence, the most exciting bits, weren't they, were the first 15 and the last 5 or so, maybe a few more. Along comes T20, which is basically the one day as without the boring bit.
Cut out the middle overs and you've got the first 15 plus the last 5, and that gives you the 20 overs.
So, since T20 has become popular or came in and started becoming popular, whether the popularity of 50-50 has waned dramatically, hasn't it?
Very, very much so, both on television and in crowd numbers.
Do you think it's because what we've said, that's only our opinion or my opinion, that you realised that the one days were boring or that? Or do you, are there other reasons you think?
I think it is partly boring, but I think it's just a saturation of cricket and people only have so many dollars and so much time, and where they want to invest that time to either go and watch it or sit in TV and watch it.
I think that's an excellent point when you say it, Greg, because as time's moved on, we've become such a time-poor society. Who's got a whole day to invest in a one-day game? And one thing about the one day is, yeah, occasionally there's exciting ones that people remember. You know, that the World Cup against South Africa and England, Michael Bevan against the
Windies.
Always
that SCG. Michael Bevan won at the SCG.
Never forgotten. But generally speaking, they're forgotten the next day.
They are. They're meaningless.
Meaningless. Whereas Test cricket always meant something. So another thing against the one day is, and yeah, time poor society. Who's got that time to invest, particularly those boring 30? That's a lot of time. That's nearly 2 hours of cricket, 30 overs.
And you've got to do that. You've got to do that twice, once for both teams. Yeah. So.
Snooze fests. The public sort of woke up and thought, hang on, this is not quality product for my, the output's not worth my investment of time. And so when would you say, early 2010s,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, I'd say 2010, 13, that sort of range, it really started to die off.
Die off, and then the ratings as such, TV ratings kept dropping, and the unthinkable 30 years ago, 20 years ago, the one-dayers weren't, no free-to-air station, one of them.
No, it's only on pay, in Australia, it's only on pay TV now, and the way our pay TV laws work is that Australian cricket or any national sport needs to go be offered to free-to-air TV first before it goes behind a paywall, and the stations weren't interested in that 50-over product.
No, because just not enough people were watching it. And it's remained that way. I saw an article this morning talking of it going back to free-to-air, but I don't know who or why. I'll be surprised if that happens anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't know what you'd do. You know, you're not going to get rid of 2020. I worry 2020 is going to go the same way, and there's oversaturation. You and I have talked about that as well. An oversaturation of that style of the game, even more so.
Yeah, and they certainly won't get 30 years out of it like they did out of 50-50. Yeah, but it was just a gradual, wasn't it? A good 20 years of everyone thinking it was the best, not everyone, but majority of cricket people thinking it was, me included, the best thing since sliced bread.
Me included as well. I thought it was amazing growing up. Loved it.
And then along comes T20, and now, yeah, it's sort of opened people's eyes and thinking, yeah, well, I don't want to spend a whole day.
Yeah, I'm happy to invest 3 hours, but I'm not happy to invest a whole day.
That's the thing. You can argue T20 is meaningless. Yes, it is, totally. But as you said, Greg, it's a football game. It's 3 hours rather than 7 or 8, you know, with lunch breaks and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so that's contributed to 50-50 cricket just, yeah, not being part of the public's consciousness anymore.
So I don't know what the answer is going forward. I mean, economically, they can't keep playing 50-over cricket like we saw last night, in the fact that, you know, you got two of the best international teams in the world, great history of competition against each other. Traditionally, any England-Australia match would be a sellout of any format of the game. And I think there's about 12,000 people in a stadium that seats 45,000.
No one there, said a few of the members and very few others.
Exactly. And look, it was a midweek. It was a Thursday night. But it was a day-night match.
Day-night against the old enemy.
That old history of going in after work didn't happen.
Yep. We're talking games that were always sellouts before against England and day-nighters.
Well, remember, Adelaide used to host the Australia Day weekend of...
A triple header.
Triple header. Or fame doesn't happen anymore, but as we said, there used to be a triangular series with three nations, and over Australia Day long weekend in January, Adelaide always hosted the triple header.
One day would be without Australia. Yes. Obviously, the crowds would be lower.
And then Australia played alternating the two other teams.
And it was, yes, sellouts. How things have changed. But something else that will affect, I remember talking to my dad about this, and even he conceded, the popularity of one-dayers, whether you liked them or not, it basically gave the cricket board the money. It basically paid for the Sheffield Shield. Do you know how the Sheffield Shield cost? It cost millions.
Well, they're still flying teams around the country and putting them up for 4 days or 5 days while the competition's going on, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, It is, some games are shown on some sort of net platforms now, but no income from it, no crowd receipts, and expensive business. The one days gave them the in their coffers to pay for all that, but you know now, well, that's it's not popular. So T20 sort of taken that spot, but for how long? The as we mentioned, but we're chatting before, the BBL is starting to.
It's waning the last couple of years. The crowds of numbers have dropped. The ratings have dropped on the BBL, and that started how many years ago now? What are we up to? BBL 10? Might be 10 years ago, there, give or take. It was probably the number one summer sport at the time. I don't think it is anymore.
No, and very disappointingly, I think, at the when it first started, they talked about the authorities need to be very careful and kill the golden goose. And, of course, what have they done? No, we won't oversaturate. Because remember the first few seasons were just started just before or just after Christmas?
Just before
Christmas. Finished by Australia Day or around that time. And then they extended the season. It used to be, what, 8-9 games each?
Yeah, and then they extended it.
14-15, and it starts mid-December, goes, I don't think it's over by start of February. It's and way too long, and the interest from the public is it's just not there anymore. Not in those numbers. Yes, it you know it has a call of, they still probably get 2/3 crowds to most stadiums when it's on. So it's still popular, but certainly not as popular, and always and it's been steadily declining. So that's a worry for cricket authorities. So back to the one day is then they're almost well. If there wasn't a one day World Cup every 4 years, totally irrelevant. I think
it would die. I don't think the 50 over game only because the ICC maintains a 50 over World Cup every 4 years that. Countries even partake in the 50-over game at all now.
And how long do you think that'll continue?
That's what I was about to ask you. How long do you think that'll continue? Look, next one's in India, which is obviously a cricket-loving nation, so it'll be interesting. I think a lot could happen with the crowds they get through the gates in India.
Yeah, traditionally, I think I still get pretty healthy crowds in India, particularly when India are playing international. But beyond that, I think it's... Who knows what's going to happen? I just don't see a place for it.
I don't either anymore. And I don't, as I've said this publicly and I've said it to you a lot, I don't love 2020 cricket, but I don't see where 50 over cricket fits between it. And I think the other thing that's happened, which we didn't touch on, there's been, particularly in Australia, a rise in interest in test cricket.
Yes.
So where 50 over cricket rose because there was no crowds or interest in test cricket, and they were only getting their couple of thousand people, Test cricket in Australia has had a reinvention, a rejuvenation, where they do sell out. You know, Boxing Day at the MCG, you do get your 80, 90,000. New Year's Test in Sydney, you do get the 40,000 most years. So there's been a lot of interest in Test cricket, and they're getting crowds back through the gates for that, which makes one day cricket, 50 over cricket between that and between Test and 20, even more irrelevant.
It does. Totally agree with that. And good to see with Test cricket too. It's not just the older folk either. A lot of young people still have very high interest in it. I heard a debate about this, and the bottom line people agreed is why? Because Test cricket means something. End of the day, it means something. The results mean something. And the way it's played now, as you mentioned before, Greg, now, like to some people, they'll always perceive Test cricket as slow and boring. You have a look now. Okay, the over rates can be lifted and all that. You watch, you know, an hour or so of Test cricket, nearly every bad ball goes.
Look, I will say the 50-over game has had a positive influence on the aggressiveness played in Test cricket. It's not played like a 50-over or 2020 game, but that sort of mentality has morphed into Test cricket, and they're far more aggressive. And as you said, rather than leaving the bad ball, very few are left. They'll be hit for runs now.
And it's not to say, look, some people are, yes, I think it is relevant to say that they do struggle now, some batsmen, in building a long innings, patience sometimes, and that is due to the shorter formats. But generally speaking, any decent test player still needs to have a good defensive technique. You know, leaving the ball is still an important part of the game and all that. But as we've kept saying, though, generally speaking, if it's there to be hit, they'll take advantage of it, which leads, you know, these days, four and over. He's not Australia. When the last 10 years, 15 years, when we're really good, our run rate per over was in a day 300 in a day was just average. And we used to often score 400 in a day plus.
Look, I Test cricket's not going anywhere. It's ebbed and flowed, but it's not going anywhere. So the question is, can 50 over cricket and 20 over cricket fit in the calendar? And more importantly, can it fit in people's time and money? And I don't think it can.
No, neither do I.
And I don't think the institution behind it has the endless pockets to keep supporting it or backing it up. Because you're only getting 17,000 at the Adelaide Oval. It would have cost that much to host or organise that game.
And also, just something else, Greg. Yesterday, I was just quickly flicking through the TV. The Marsh Cup, the state one-day competition. Like, the cost of that. And really, what are they playing for? The next level is to be played for Australia, who plays, five, six a year if they're lucky now.
Handful now, maybe 10 a year at most.
Would it not be better to go like it used to be and majority of it playing more shield cricket, preparing for test match players? We could talk about this for a long time.
But that's probably, no answers, a lot of questions, but that's probably brought us to the end of our pod this week.
It has. Look, be very, very interesting to see if one day cricket's around in 20 years.
I was going to say 10. 10. See, I think you're being kind. I think
10.
Over the next 10 years, I'll be interested and surprised if in its format now, if it still exists at all.
Yeah. Look, so by all means, you have an opinion, let us know. I know some people who are still very big fans of one day cricket. Their arguments are reasonably sound. They argue, but you still have to build an innings. You have to bat well. You have to bowl well. Fielding, it does improve. Fielding is very important, like it is in T20. So, it's got some important aspects to it. But as for all the reasons we've discussed, I just don't think it can be. I was saying it's sustainable.
No, I'm not sure whether it's sustainable financially.
But please let us know what you think or anything else we've discussed.
Any questions or feedback or comments or opinions or topics you'd like us to talk about, please get in touch. twosportingmuppets@gmail.com. Love your feedback. Love any, topics to talk about or any, your opinions based on what we do talk about.
As always. But thanks for your time, everyone. Really appreciate you listening in. And we really look forward to catching up with you again in hopefully a week's time.
Anyway, thanks for another great chat, Gray, and thanks to all the listeners out there.
Thanks, Greg. Okay, we'll see you next week.
See you in a week.